We're back. This is tape three, side B now. You were talking about the Ganetsky lab. You had described sort of a typical day. I guess we should. Oh, here. There's one thing in your CV that I thought was interesting. A couple things, but this was one of them. In 1989, you're given the Lubrizol Industrial Fellowship. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, but I'm not sure that that had any particular significance to me, because I think it was a way of the department generously finding a way to pay me when I wasn't eligible for NIH training grant funds.
Okay.
In fact, I did well out of being ineligible for training grant funds, because I think it so happened that the various fellowships they had available were trying to spread around.
Okay.
You often paid a little more than the usual, which is unfair, but true. And I always felt that I was never poor as a graduate student. I always felt well off.
Mm-hmm. All right. How do you get to the Howard Hughes Medical Institute in 1990 after your thesis?
This was a. I went there to do a particular project, to do the work on mechanotransduction, how cells convert, figure out how cells and Drosophila. Since I was stuck with Drosophila, chose to be stuck with Drosophila. How they convert stimuli like touch or sound or pressure into electrical stimuli.
And how did you come by that project?
So we need to go back to when I was in graduate school, and in some ways way back to when I was reading books by Lewis Thomas, The Lives of a Cell, which had an appeal, because like many things that have an appeal for me, it went back into the early history of things. And how those are popularizations of the idea that cells were composite and had been put together eukaryotic cells are composite and being put together from smaller cells, so that things like mitochondria and in particular cilia are relics of formerly free-living independent bacterial cells. That it's a theory that's been popularized by and originated, I don't know if it originated with Lynn Margulis, but certainly popularized by her. While I was in graduate school, I'd taken some of the courses there on trying to remedy the gaps in my education in neurobiology, because one of the things I hadn't learned at all in Trinity was any amount of good neurobiology or neurophysiology. So I'd taken some great courses from people like Donato Rattel, Tony Stretton, about cell physiology and neurophysiology in particular. Among the papers that we'd read there was one by A.J. Hudspeth on, I think, one of the earliest demonstrations that where the mechanosensing cells were on a hair cell. And they had done that by antiferecing an antibiotic, streptomycin, which acts as a blocker of the channel on hair cell. Even though we don't know it, we still don't know what the molecular identity of the channel on a hair cell is, they were able to show where it was on the cell and that it was, in fact, located at the tips of these little bundles of microvilli at the tip of a cell.
Mm-hmm.
By focal antiferesis, puffing on little squirts of this antibiotic, streptomycin, that blocks the channels. Streptomycin is an aminoglycoside, and in fact, if you overdose on aminoglycosides, that class of antibiotics, or if you give somebody too much of it, because you have to give them too much of it to cure an infectious disease, or very often you go deaf. There's a hepatotoxic effect on the hair cells, perhaps by blocking the channels, perhaps by some other effects in the cell. I'm not sure that's entirely clear. The reason I'm going into this is because the other thing I knew about streptomycin and was that I knew about its site of action. I knew about on bacteria and how it how it kills or stops, blocks the replication of bacteria. It binds to a small ribosomal subunit, in fact, to a small ribosomal RNA. I knew about that because it was the subject of my undergraduate thesis that I'd done way back. And I also knew that from Drosophila in the work that there was a mutation called technical knockout. I have to ask me about fly mutant names later. But, which is one of the bang sensitive mutations. Bang, knock the flies around, they're vile a bit, and they paralyze. And they go into a seizure, and they can't get up for a while. Mm. Hence TKO. TKO turned out to be when somebody did the positional cloning on it. I think it was in... No, I'm not sure where it was done. Or to whom to give the credit to. It turned out to be the... what looked like the S12, the small ribosomal subunit protein, which is the site of mutations to streptomycin resistance. And I thought, wow, here's a connection that seems strange and maybe is really telling us something deep about that ribosomal proteins might be doing something other than, and ribosomal RNAs might be doing something other than just being ribosomes. And since I've got a taste in science for the things that go way back in evolution and are slightly flaky, the idea that ribosomal RNAs might be doing things other than just being ribosomal RNAs in the cell appealed. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there might be a deeper connection there. So I went, did a lot of reading on what was known about hair cells and what was known about, to see if there was any possible connection. And as far as I could tell then, can tell now, there isn't. But the amount of reading I did was enough to get me hooked on the idea of here's a apparently simple but strangely unexplored process of mechanotransduction.
Mm-hmm.
It should be simple. We should know. It seems like, okay, you hit a cell, it changes its membrane potential. This is something that electrophysiologists always try to avoid. We've got our electrophysiology rigs mounted on these big, awkward, heavy air tables to avoid all mechanical vibration. This is something that cells seems to happen. Mechanical disturbance changes cells' potential sometimes when we don't want it to, and yet we still don't know how it happens. So that combination of unexplored, you know, the place on the map, here be dragons, unexplored area,
right.
was at once interesting, the possibility of a genetic approach, again, of it was the... People had already begun to do a lot, had already done quite a lot, bit of work on phototransduction. They were on their way, it appeared, to solving smell, and this seemed to be the last unexplored sense. So I thought it would be a good idea to think about doing a postdoc on that project.
Right.
I went to... I considered a couple of labs to do it in, and... ended up in Charles Zucker's lab, because in part because he'd come and given a talk on photoreception and what the work his lab was doing then at Wisconsin. I thought it was a great talk. He had that quality and has that quality, which I mentioned before, of energy, of putting the energy into a presentation, and also which he also puts into his science. He has and gives off that aura of success. This is a place and somebody who could make a project work.
Mm-hmm.
And also because he was, by then he was Howard Hughes funded, and he obviously had the resources to make it work. Right. And because he was very interested in the idea too. He also wanted to do something other than photoreception. And the idea of starting a project mechanoreception appealed to him as it did to me. So he was up for it.
Hmm.
He's gone on since to cover all the other senses as well.
Was it said before we start talking about your postdoc work that your thesis eventually wins the Salem Memorial Award?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Fairly impressive.
That was the most terrifying experience of my life. Was
in what way?
Giving that, because that it requires you to give a presentation, the first plenary presentation at the annual Drosophila meeting,
right,
which is a relatively small meeting, but still 2,000, an audience of 2,000 or so can still seem quite large, especially when it's in a mirror-lined hall in a big hotel room in Chicago.
That'll do it.
And particularly when someone, right before you, as you take your first breath to speak, somebody starts playing the bagpipes outside the hall. No idea where that came from. It broke the tension.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, before we talk about your work in Zucker's lab, talk about Charles Zucker and his laboratory management style.
Very different from Barry's. One rarely had to go looking for Charles because he would often come looking for you just to find out what was going on. Always very enthusiastic about whatever project, you know, would always bring a level of enthusiasm and energy to whatever project he wanted to back. But I'll sometimes be equally enthusiastic in his denunciations of why something wouldn't work, or whether it was a lousy experiment or a lousy manuscript. Or there are many Charlesisms that people, graduates of his lab, repeat as to remind themselves of time there. Exactly the words in which a piece of bad writing would be described. But but he did have what, and what the project needed, a lot of support, enthusiasm, willingness to take a risk that was at the time a very long shot, and back it all the way for several years. Again, even though, just as in Barry's lab, what I'd produced probably really wasn't what he was looking for. And Charles is quite, and I are quite opposite in the sense that I am exploratory rather than goal-directed. He's very goal-directed and mission-oriented, very effective in that way. But so he was looking for the mechanoreceptor and wanted to, you know, mount as efficient and as fast a way of finding it as possible.
Right.
I was looking for whatever would happen to turn up, and probably wasn't nearly as fast as he would have liked, and, nor necessarily as goal-directed. But he still, for most of the time I was there, I was operating independently of the rest of the lab.
Right.
Most of the when I came, I was the only I was the first person there not to work in phototransduction. For much of the time there, I was the only person working on mechanotransduction. But he still, you know, I got half of the time of technician David Cowan, which was a big help when doing a lot of the genetic screening, and never lacked for resources.
Mm-hmm.
All the time I was in the lab, and it was a long postdoc. It was 4 years with no publication until the end of that project.
Right.
Since then, I think it's probably he recouped at least some of his investment, I think, in the long run. Since then, Richard Walker's been able to follow me on the project, and they got a great paper out of that on one of the beginning from one of the mutations that we'd isolated.
Right. How big was that lab?
Bigger, up to 20 people at a time. It's also gone up and down a bit, but on average, much larger. Mm-hmm. Different lab space too. Open plan lab space for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
A larger group.
And could you give us maybe an overview of the work that you did in mechanotransduction?
I started trying a non-genetic approach, trying to do subtractive hybridization, in part because that was something that had worked before for their lab in phototransduction. One of their big resources had been a set of, I think, cDNA clone, no, it was a subtractive cDNA probe that had been isolated by taking flies with normal eyes, flies without eyes, subtracting the message from those two tissues, so to leave things or enrich for things that are expressed specifically in the eye, and using that as a tool to get things that would genes that would be expressed only in the eye, and therefore genes that would probably function in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
We'd had the first idea was to find flies without bristles. A lot of our work is on mechanosensory bristles. All the little hairs that cover a fly are all sense organs. We had a mutation that overproduced bristles from Jim Pozzacconi's lab, also at San Diego, called Bearded. A fly without bristles, almost completely without bristles, skewed 10-1, and was to make RNA from both flies and try to subtract one from the other. Didn't work. In part because it's not quite the same as the eye. Bristles are scattered all over the fly, so you don't have a single tissue. A lot of the enrichment in the eye experiments came from the fact that you can cut off a fly's head, and shake and sieve to get many, many thousands of fly's heads. A fly's head is probably half eye, so there's a lot of enrichment even just in that step without the subtraction. We can't do that for bristles. They're evenly spread and scattered all over the fly. The subtractive hybridization itself, I probably wasn't skilled enough to bring it off, and I'm not sure that the method I was trying to do with hydroxyapatite chromatography would have worked. There seems to be a fraction of message that just won't subtract, not for the reasons that you want. I've since thought of there's been other technical improvements by other people that have improved it, and if I was going, you could think about different ways of doing it then. But I had, after about 9 months, I think Charles and I sat down, and pretty much he told me to go and do it genetically. That was more what I was used to doing anyway. I was happier doing that.
Right.
So what we began with was a figuring out a screen that would and allow us to detect flies that seem to be insensitive to touch. And my bias was to be able to do it previously from Charles' background at phototransduction. There was work that had been done on things like sort of a little countercurrent apparatus for flies where you could find flies that would or would not move towards light. And we spent a while just thinking about different ways, tools, obstacle courses, substrates of different hardness or thing that would, where you could build some sort of obstacle course for flies that would channel them into ones that were and ones that weren't sensitive to touch.
Right.
But my preference, again, was, I think, for direct observation, going back to the idea that you learn even without, when you look at something, you take in so much information just by looking, that it's better to do things that way. Even if you're not necessarily going to use all that information, it's always better to look at what you're screening. Mm-hmm. So I decided to screen flies when they were larvae. And in this way, this was conceptually mimic a screen that had been done already in C. neurobditis, which all along has been our not quite hated rival, but let's say very well respected rival in this work. Martin Chalfy, working in England, and I think with John Selston, had done a screen for touch insensitive worms, for touch insensitive nematodes, and had pulled out a whole bunch of genes. And has since gone on to make probably a very complete model of mechanotransduction, in luckily a different sort of cell than the one we were interested in doing. But we were, okay, let's look at the fly when it's a worm, when it's a larva. So what I did with David Cowan also helped me with for several months, was generating many, about 5,500 families of flies, each one of which would have a different mutagenized chromosome, where the sons in those families would express the mutant phenotype of any mutation that happened on the X chromosome. And we grew the flies in 24 well tissue plates, so it was a matter of sorting, sitting down each day with maybe a stack of 5 or 6 24 well plates, each one with a 2-day-old group of larvae in the bottom of each well, tickling those with a very expensive instrument, which was an eyelash stuck on the end of a stick, and trying to, first of all, work out, is there a stereotypical behavioral response to when you stroke a larva with an eyelash? Yes, there was. Can we see any differences from that response in our mutagenized populations and mutagenized families of larvae? And yes, we could. And from that came a set of about 50 mutations, most of which we still don't know what's wrong with them. But the genes we seem to be hitting most often, the genes we hit several times, which is always a good indication that you're onto something, turned out to be what we were looking for. It turned out to be larvae that were defective in mechanosensation. One of my favorite, what I still show as a slide of one of my favorite experiments, is a genetic mosaic fly. That mosaic being an animal which has, where different parts of its body have different genotypes. usually random patches of mutant tissue in an otherwise wild-type animal,
mm-hmm.
Where we could just tickle to show that that fly had any mutant patch was numb, and non-mutant patches weren't numb. And that told us that it was a defect in the sensory, even though when you do a behavioral screen, you can get a defect. A defect could be due, in theory, to either the motor output from the central nervous system as well as the sensory input, or something in the central nervous system itself. That experiment to show that mutant patches of tissue on the outside of the fly were the numb patches of tissue, that told us that it was a sensory defect.
Right.
So I always liked that experiment because it was so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Did I mention that I was frugal? I still am.
Mm-hmm. And how about a typical day? I mean, did you pretty much keep the routine that you had when you were in grad school, coming in about 9:30?
Again, it went into phases depending on whether we were in that early screening stage or later on.
Right.
I lived all the places I'd always... Apart from that, I'm going to go way back when I was commuting into school with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
That was okay going commuting with my dad on the train, but when I started commuting on the bus and got stuck in traffic jams, I hated it. I've always hated commuting. So, and as soon as I could assert my independence, I was cycling into school through inner city traffic from the age of 12 onwards. And always since, I've preferred to live within biking distance of work. So that was the case in Madison. I've biked through not all Madison, Wisconsin winters, but some of them, and still live within a biking, what should be a 10-minute, but it is actually a 15-minute trip on a bike from my lab. So I would come in. I lived close enough so I could come in. Yeah, I could have come in at 8 a.m., but somehow I never managed to. I got up later.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, I think the mornings, people always manage to get in early and to Charles's lab for lab meetings, because the punishment for arriving late was that you had to buy the pizza for that.
Interesting. When would you usually leave? Or would that be, again, dependent on what experiments?
Again, it depended on what experiments. I would spend a lot of... Again, I liked going home and then coming back in the evenings.
Right. Okay. How do you eventually come to accept a position here in Stony Brook? And that happens, what, in 1994? Five?
Let's see. Well, came time to look for a job when we thought we had enough of a portable project,
mm-hmm.
to bring with me. Did about 11 different interviews, job interviews. It was a very strange period,
mm-hmm.
in my life. I'm not sure there's anything quite as strange as that first round of job interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Very educational, though. You see, it's a... Particularly if you do that many, although they seem at times to blur into one another if you try to string more of the two together on a single trip,
mm-hmm.
Just by interacting. It's after, partly because of the sort of scientist I was pretty insular and isolated as a postdoc, but all of a sudden having to both appear intelligent when talking about many different scientists about many different topics,
mm-hmm.
It forced you to think on your feet a lot better. Of those, I got offers from a few places, and Stony Brook appealed in some ways because it was a place where I could do the science I wanted, where resources wouldn't be limiting, but which was a great place to live, and
right.
that was having a place to live was by then as important to me as optimizing the places to do science. There were one or two places from which I had offers that I think the people were surprised I didn't go to, because they were more prestigious. But the quality of life there, I don't think wouldn't have been as good.
Right.
By that stage, I was married and had a child on the way.
And when did you marry?
In San Diego, 1982.
1982. Okay.
1992, sorry.
92. And you had one child?
We had, our daughter was born 2 months after we moved to San Diego. 2 months after we moved to Stony Brook.
Right.
So, let's see, Karen would have been pregnant. I'm not sure if she was pregnant at the time I was doing my first round of interviews. But it was certainly, it was certainly a consideration at that time. By the time I was into the second round of interviews, she was.
Okay. And what was the startup package that Stony Brook gave you?
$160,000 with, I think, about $25,000 extra for supplies. They renovated lab space, not the space you're in currently. I've moved labs since for me, and no salaries were included in that.
So it all had to be made up by grants.
I'm trying to remember how we paid for the first few technicians. I don't know. I think I was able to pay from salaries out of that, but there was no money specifically set aside for, you weren't given a technician or anything to start with. Mm-hmm. So recruiting people had to be done right from the start.
Mm-hmm. And then what was the hardest part about setting up your lab?
Recruiting people.
Almost
from both from the point of view of, well, there was some, I found the some of the bureaucracy at Stony Brook not particularly helpful. There's a lot of, it's not a particularly streamlined place.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to be that, I think because of where they'd got some of the School of Medicine money that they'd got, had to go pass through some exceptionally sticky desks before a purchase request ever got off campus. But that long run didn't prove to be... Well, no, I think it didn't seem to be an issue at the time, though. I think if you added up all of the time spent dealing with purchase request orders that seemed to go awry, having to learn a system that wasn't all that functional to begin with, and where who you knew was as important as to follow the rules, when some of the rules weren't followed and some were, and there wasn't clear which rules could be followed,
mm-hmm.
and which ones could be ignored. I think that amounted at the time to a considerable cost in starting up here. I'm not sure I can say that I would have managed particularly well, even if things had been better. But lab management was something that I've had to learn and still have to learn. Lab management in the equipment and logistics sense. The other, so you're at, just say the question again.
I was asking, what was the hardest thing about setting up your lab? You'd mentioned
initially, I think, though, the hardest part, the thing that gave me most stress, though, was the idea of being responsible for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Having, even at the time, even say having undergrads in the lab, being responsible for their time or having responsible for their salaries, even the hires that I would make now at very short notice and without thinking to agonizing them over too much, I spent probably way too much time agonizing over.
Mm-hmm.
Also, recruiting graduate students and postdocs were not easy to come by. Graduate students, because although there are plenty of graduate students at Stony Brook, there are also a very large number of labs, and it seemed to be hard for more junior labs to recruit students. They understandably were often attracted to programs by more famous, well set up, mm-hmm. better established labs. I found it necessary to be a member of four different graduate programs in order to have a chance of recruiting any graduate students at all.
Wow.
And so, for instance, I'm in the neurobiology department. The neurobiology department has its own graduate program, but it was relatively small then, maybe 6 students a year. Now it's probably up to near 11, 10 or 11. But most of those people would come in specifically interested in integrative neurobiology, which I wasn't doing. Molecular and cellular biology is a large number. Genetics is a large number of students, but they get spread out over quite a large number of labs. In the long run, it's worked out okay. I think at one point I had a graduate student in the neurobiology program who was quite very good, but didn't like lab work, and eventually she quit with a master's degree, much to my disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
But probably to her she was probably happier, probably better off. It was probably the right decision for her.
Right. How often you confer with members of your lab?
Varies. We try to have lab meetings about weekly, but I'm mostly through. Sometimes once we get to the end of a cycle, many weeks will often go by before it gets restarted.
Mm-hmm.
Though I'll try to, again, manage a lot by casual interaction and try to keep abreast of things in the lab by hanging out there sometimes, just as Barry used to do, push flies.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that anybody else who's pushing flies around, that I know what they're doing, and they know what they're doing and why they're doing it. It'll vary a lot between some of the people in my lab are extremely experienced by now, and then it goes all the way down to newly arrived undergrads.
Right. And how often, I mean, do you have, for instance, meetings, and how often, journal clubs? How do you structure your lab, I guess?
Less than I ought to.
Mm-hmm.
We do have weekly lab meetings. I have for one project recently that is somewhat self-contained and on which most of the people working on are more junior. I'm having an extra meeting each week on that project alone. That's the first time I've done something like that, having a meeting of a section of the lab that others are, they're welcome to attend, but they don't have to.
Right.
Journal clubs we've had in the past, but we also participate in some interlab journal clubs or interlab research series. The little center that we're in, which is about seven labs, there's a monthly seminar, research seminar, that usually we present in every about twice a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I'd say we could probably use more. I could probably do more to foster interactions that I'm doing now. A lot of it's done person to person. The big whiteboard,
right,
in my office is, I made sure to get the biggest one I could.
Right. You can never have enough whiteboard.
That's what I meant.
All right, tell me a little bit about the current projects that you have underway. And again, I'll ask you to sort of explain it in terms that maybe a bright non-scientist
right.
might understand.
I'm not sure that they need it to be dumbed down, because I do tend to think in as simple and mechanical terms as much as possible myself. But sort of going from the original roots of the project, one line of work continues that on, in looking for the molecules that mediate transduction of mechanical senses.
Mm-hmm.
And the first gene that we cloned was a gene called NOMP-A for no mechanoreceptor potential A. I view my greatest failing in this area, by the way, is the failure to come up with imaginative names for my own mutants. One of the things I really like about Drosophila work is that you can get to name your own mutants. But
mm-hmm.
I can give some of my favorites later. Now, NOMP-A is a protein that we found by positional cloning, would not have found had we been. Except we've not been doing a positional cloning project, and it looks like it's something that serves as an extracellular mechanical linker to the cell that's been doing the transduction. That
mm-hmm.
is, it's part of a structure that transmits the movement or stretch or whatever the mechanical stimulus is to the sensory ending of the neuron that's going to be affected by that stimulus. If you don't have it, the sensory endings come detached from structures on the outside like bristles, and they no longer work. When trying to get that work published, we came up against the phrase, which we now kind of repeat with varying degrees of irony to each other, called non-specific glue. You thought, this is just non-specific glue, it's not worthy of a neuron paper. But we've been finding lately, particularly since the mosquito genome was sequenced, makes a great comparison to fly genes, separated by 250 million years of evolution, so anything that can be changed will be, but things that are functionally important are conserved. Nambe is really highly conserved, much more than you would expect for an extracellular protein. So even though perhaps devalued it a little bit once we got it, our first paper in, now we're going back and revisiting it and thinking that, oh, it looks like all those arguments that we made about the reviewers, are in fact true. And we're going back and doing things like swapping subdomains of it.
Right.
It's one of a larger class of protein called ZP domain proteins, zona pellucida domain proteins, which are found in specialized matrices like coatings of vertebrate eggs, and also in the vertebrate inner ear, even though the particular proteins, tectorins, that are ZP proteins in the inner ear, we can't really claim them as homologs to Nompe, but they're at least analogs. They do the same job. There's still hints of something, a deeper connection there, that might be telling us about the way signaling in these sensory cells is done. The real prize, though, and probably what certainly Charles was hoping for when I began this project as a postdoc in his lab, is the ion channels that's been better opened. And his lab was the first to clone one of those from a mutation that I'd isolated. Richard Walker then went on and did a great job of not only doing the molecular biology, but also the electrophysiology on that mutant to show that it, first of all, it was likely to encode a channel, and then going on to show that it did, in fact, encode a particular ion channel of a superfamily called a TRIP family. Though it's not nailed down yet, it's very likely that this is the transducer channel in fly bristles. And recently, in collaboration with a couple of other labs, one in Korea and one in Virginia, we've been able to find two other channels that look like they may be the channels for a different sort of sense organ, the one that mediates fly hearing. So what I'd sort of set as the culmination for, not the culmination, but a goal for this line of work, would be how to reconstitute a mechanosensing system. That means that putting it back together apart, when you've taken things apart, which geneticists are very good at breaking things so they don't work anymore, the hard part is putting it back together again so that it works. That is, taking the isolated bits that you've identified and putting them back together in a different system, in such a way that you can say, look, we understand the system so well that we can put it back together so that we now reconstitute transducing. We put these three molecules back in. This shows that you really know what's going on. If you can reproduce the response, the change in membrane potential in a reconstituted system. The problem with mechanotransduction is that it's a complex in a cellular way. It's very dependent on all the specialized architecture of a sensory cell. If you take, say, a ligand-gated receptor, or a receptor that's activated or a channel that's opened by a single molecule binding to it, as many are, you can take that, put it into a standard expression system like a frog egg, spritz on, get it, the frog egg will obligingly produce the channel, put it in the membrane, you can spritz on your ligand, your activator molecule, and you can record the activity of the channel if you have the right channel. Mechanotransduction, that's probably never going to be possible because it doesn't depend on a channel being activated by a single diffusing molecule, but by a direct mechanical connection to specialized extracellular structures, possibly the structure in which the Nambe protein is in. So rebuilding, reconstituting this system from isolated parts is going to be more difficult, we think. But we'll probably still do it. I think now that we have good channels, or the likely candidate transducer channels identified, that's an important step on the way there. So that's transduction. The whole area that that the mutants opened up to us, though, that we hadn't anticipated on getting into, but we're now pursuing, is how you develop these sensory endings in the first place. And this goes way back to some of the early, back to Lewis Thomas, back to the Lives of a Cell, back to the idea of, back to this fascination with cilia. Cilia are these things that stick out of cells. They've got this specialized, very beautiful symmetric architecture. And in most cells, they're either waving around to propel something else along or to propel the cell along, if it's something like a sperm cell or a flagellated algal cell. These are what cells swim with or propel fluids with. But they can also be modified as sense organs, as sensory endings. So the specialized light-sensitive endings in your eye are all modified cilia, things that stick out of a cell and have been modified, in that case, to contain a whole lot of light-sensitive molecules. In our cells, they're modified. They have each sensory neuron has a single sensory ending tipped, and at its tip is a modified cilium that, for reasons we don't know yet, is mechanosensitive. And in fact, the very first mutant we isolated, which is called UNC because it's uncoordinated, turned out to be a defect in formation of the cilium. Not only did it not transduce, but it couldn't, because those ciliated sensory endings are missing. The only ciliated cells in a fly are sensory neurons and sperm, so flies are actually a good way of studying this, because the fly can have no cilia and still survive. Mm. And the origins of cilia are very intriguing and mysterious. And a cilia grows from a basal body, which is like a barrel built of triplets of microtubules, again in the nice symmetric circle, 9 triplets. And that basal body used to be a centriole. A centriole is the same thing that organizes the spindle of a mitotically dividing cell. At each end of a dividing cell, you have a spindle that pulls the chromosomes apart in a very carefully orchestrated dance. And each centrosome, at the poles of a spindle, you have centrosomes. Each centrosome is 2 centrioles and other stuff. When a cell finishes dividing, those centrioles can migrate to the surface of the cell, and one of them does this completely different cell biological job of organizing a cilium, mm-hmm. in some cells. And how a centriole goes from organizing my spindle to doing this completely different job is pretty much not known. It's a really fascinating issue, because it goes way back to the very earliest history of eukaryotic cells, and they're very fundamental. Centrioles have been objects of fascination and mystery for about 100 years now, since they were first identified. And they have a strange way of being duplicated that's tied to the cell cycle, but still quite mysterious. It's not certain what their origins are, but my bet is that their origins were, in fact, as cilia or as ciliary organizers. Mm-hmm. And then there's been this strain in cell biological thinking that cilia also, just like mitochondria, isolated as semi-independent entities, were some other sort of cell that became associated with the eukaryotic cell. So it was, in fact, something that now has a very central role in cell division, was in fact an invader or a symbiont or a parasite.
Right.
We're hoping to at least get a clue about how these get an insight back into the deep history of centrioles and how basal bodies and cilia, by looking at our mutants in which cilia failed to form, particularly from one of them, where the protein we found, which is called the UNC protein, seems to associate specifically with centrioles. Here's where we get into stuff that's hard to convey in tape, because the things that have been most informative to us have been pictures, mm-hmm. and the technique that's been most informative has been the method of tagging proteins with GFP, green fluorescent protein. So we do a lot of cell biological techniques of confocal microscopy, immunohistochemical staining, to localize these proteins in cells and in sensory endings to try and find out what they do.
Right. So
reading it on my list of projects. We have so many projects going in the lab that I haven't written up on the board. I'm reading, facing the whiteboard now, reading from the list. We're about halfway down now.
Right.
But I'll summarize the rest more briefly. We've got besides ciliogenesis and transduction. We've started a third project area now on polycystins, a set of ion channels that in humans are the site of mutations to polycystic kidney disease. And we think also have a lot to do with ciliary signaling in ciliated cells and in cilia. We have a couple of other smaller projects going, but they tend to fall into those three main areas.
Okay. I'm going to flip over the tape. I'll get a new one.